You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
It is a great honour to welcome my friend, President Oolong, and his delegation for their first state visit to the United States. In fact, the first state visit by a French president in nearly 20 years.
It's cold in Washington.
It's been a busy week for diplomats all around the world. The author and commentator Peter York and RUSI's Matthew Jameson will join me to talk best practice on the foreign policy field. Also ahead, Anastasia Maloney talks South American pacts, all-women buses and wiretapping scandals in Bogota. Then we'll review a new book on the rise and fall and rise and fall again of the home of Memphis Soul. Isaac Hayes ahead on the programme. All that and more coming up today on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to on today's edition of Midori House. Then, before we get started, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who's here with a bulletin of the latest world news.
UN aid agencies have said they're increasingly concerned about the fate of hundreds of men and boys who've been evacuated from homes. More than 300 have been held for questioning by Syrian authorities. And while the governor of Homs says more than 100 have been released, Melissa Fleming from the UNHCR has concerns about those who remain in custody.
There were several hundred who were either above the age of 15 or below the age of 55. These are men, and they are being questioned by authorities in the presence of UNHCR and UNICEF in a school on the outskirts of Homs.
Meanwhile, the UN mediator leading talks on the crisis in Syria says there's been no progress yet at the second round of negotiations in Geneva. But Lakhdar Brahimi says he has tons of patience and will keep working. Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad accuses the opposition of refusing to hold sensible discussions.
We and these people have to prepare themselves for a sound discussion. Today they wasted all the time discussing nothing, saying that there is no terrorism in Syria. Do you want to lose all the time, you waiting here also for such silly discussions?
Local media in Algeria say that more than 100 people have been killed after a plane crash in the northeast of the country. What's thought to have been a military transport plane came down in mountains around 300 miles from the capital, Algiers. The High Court in London has ordered the British government to reconsider its decision not to hold a public inquiry into the murder of a former Russian spy in London. Alexander Litvinenko died 8 years ago after being poisoned with a radioactive substance. Moscow has always denied any involvement in his killing. The coroner in charge of the inquest into Mr. Litvinenko's death had requested a public inquiry, but that was refused by the country's interior minister, Theresa May. China and Taiwan have held their first high-level talks in 65 years. China continues to regard Taiwan as part of its territory and has a stated aim of reclaiming the island. But the head of China's delegation at the talk said imagination was needed to resolve the issues between them. No significant breakthroughs are expected at these first talks, which are seen more as an attempt to build confidence between the two sides. Police in Italy and the United States have broken up a major transatlantic smuggling operation. They've arrested 24 people suspected of plotting to move drugs worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The operation targeted two crime families, the Gambino in New York and the Italian Andragta family. U.S. prosecutor Marshall Miller says the criminals had made a big mistake.
While the Andragta thought that crossing international boundaries would help evade the pursuit of law enforcement, what they found out this morning was that the opposite was true. Now, 24 members and associates of international organized crime are behind bars.
India has returned to the Olympic fold as a ban on its membership of the International Olympic Committee is lifted. It was imposed after a corruption scandal in 2012. As a result, Indian athletes competing at the Winter Games in Sochi are doing so under the Olympic flag. But former Indian Olympic Association President Vijay Malhotra says that will now change.
We are very happy, and we hope that in the Winter Olympics also, in the closing ceremony, as I said earlier also, that we hope that our team will march past with the Indian flag.
Shirley Temple, the child star who forged a second career as a US diplomat, has died. She was 85. At the age of 3, she landed her first role in the movies and would star in dozens more. But she retired from film in 1950 at the age of 21 and moved instead into politics and diplomacy, serving as US ambassador to Ghana and Czechoslovakia. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul Osborne will be back at the bottom of the hour. He'll have the latest world news headlines for us. But with the time at exactly 6 minutes past 1800 hours in London, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back with my special guest today right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monaco 24。Oplondo,
du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London, London.
This is Monaco 24.
Yes, you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is ticking towards 7 minutes past 1800 hours, 13:07 in New York City. Well, joining me now in the studio with their take on the news are both the author and commentator, Peter York, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the London-based think tank, RUSI. Welcome, gentlemen, both to the programme. I should say you both look impeccably attired today.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind.
And Peter, likewise.
Good. I always dress like this.
Well, absolutely, and we're happy to see it. And it's perhaps appropriate in some respects, because we're going to start with a roundup of diplomatic news. While Geneva plays host to round two of the Syria peace talks, there's also been a flurry of diplomatic activity all around the world. China and Taiwan in the midst of discussions to improve relations, hopefully. Greece and Turkey similarly breaking an established mould, coming together to talk about Cyprus. North Korea has reportedly even welcomed Donald Gregg to Pyongyang after refusing Robert King. And the EU is talking to Cuba about reinstating bilateral relations. Lots of activity, lots of talking points. Matthew, perhaps we'll start with you. Does this suggest that there is still a point to all of this diplomacy? All of these different stories, all of these tensions, it's vital that people are sitting around a table, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I come back to Winston Churchill's comment, you know, less war, more jaw, because we've really got to bear in mind that a lot of the problems in the world, a lot of the tensions and the difficulties that we deal with are actually resolved peacefully. And diplomacy plays a huge role in that. And we need to always ensure that we have open lines of communication between all groups. Unfortunately, of course, some instances, you know, you will come to the military option. But diplomacy has always got to be the first avenue, and it has to be exhausted thoroughly before you get to that stage.
Peter, do you go along with that? What about the sort of the idea of the career diplomat? Is that still as fresh and relevant a concept in
your
view?
It's a lovely idea. It isn't what people think, and it's a very varied career, being a career diplomat now. I went to an agency, a dinner recently at an embassy, where a great writer said, great writer on paper, said, as a despised species myself, you know, completely out of date, it's lovely to be amongst people yet more despised, i.e. diplomats, because he said, do you know, this was Adrian Gill, a great thinker of our time, saying, as a dead tree press person, I realise you're worse than me. But of course, this was a very clever, modern embassy in London. You think, what do most of them do all the time? And what about the other things you might be doing instead? Of course, it's much better to jaw away and try, but you think, can it possibly work? And then you think of public diplomacy, the people-to-people initiatives, and you think of all those clever things that clever diplomat for hire Ross Kahn talks about. You know, just a very, you know, send him in a on the top of a drone to bang down in those places, and he'll think of something. You know, as a freelance, as a paid freelance, freelance diplomats. I think that's the future.
That could be. What do you think about that, Matthew? You think that's a good idea?
I mean, it's already happening, actually, in a way, because we're seeing the breakdown of, you know, traditional government-to-government diplomacy run by, you know, a state's machine in terms of the foreign offices. And actually, we're seeing a greater growth in what I would call, you know, sort of track two diplomacy, or what Peter has pointed out, public diplomacy, whereby you have this proliferation of NGOs and think tanks and outside groups and, you know, and freelancers and independents who are actually undertaking diplomatic activities. For example, at RUSI, when I had just arrived, actually, and we were working on the Arab Peace Initiative project, we were able to act as a neutral venue to engage in a track two diplomacy program, where we actually were able to bring together the Israeli ambassador in London, Daniel Taub, and his Palestinian counterpart. The Palestinians, of course, don't have an official ambassador, but they have a representative, Professor Hassassian. The two of them had never met until we brought them together at RUSI, and they had their first meeting there. And you know, we are not an official government organization, but that was a sort of an example of track two diplomacy in action, where governments aren't able to step in. Maybe outside groups and individuals can do so instead.
Absolutely. It's an interesting point. Peter, I wondered, in terms of having the best people for the job, then, the idea of this freelancer, do you think that there's a case for saying, look, there's some very capable, very able people working, for example, in the private sector, and they would be good. They're used to working boardrooms. There can be blood on the floor in boardrooms at times, metaphorically, we hope. Do we miss a trick? Perhaps there's people in the private sector who should be involved in this high-level talks.
I always worry about that. I mean, there's one thing to have a professional who's gone freelance. It's another thing to say the market will provide. People who work in the marketplace are miles cleverer. There was that standard right-wing view. So, but let's put them into government. Mostly, they fail. When you look at grandees of British business who've been put into government with a great writings up and profiles and magnificent man, and they fail. They look silly. They slink out in about 9 months, and everybody's very embarrassed and never mentions it again. There was a time under Mrs. Thatcher when you thought the Marks and Spencers board will run Britain, and it didn't happen.
Why do you think that doesn't work then? Is there a reason? Is it just that these sort of bedfellows? Perhaps,
they're uncomfortable bedfellows, and they actually don't understand the principles of government. Mm-hmm. It's not just they don't get on with the civil service. They think that a limited range of measures, which is designed for a limited range of outcomes, which is called shareholder value, is the same as fixing a long-haul problem about a nation-state, and it isn't.
Let's sort of get into some of the nuts and bolts of these talks that we mentioned. Syria, I know, Matthew, we've talked a little bit before about this. It's been interesting to me that we've had Lakhdar Brahimi trying to sort of manoeuvre these talks, do a bit more manoeuvring behind the scenes. We talked a little about the problem of trying to do these things in too open a forum and having journalists and a whole huge sort of melee going on. Better outcome likely if it's done a little more with a little more subtlety?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I always come back to, unfortunately, it's maybe not a great example because it hasn't gone where we would have liked it to, but I think about the Oslo peace process, which started in the early 90s and was a real breakthrough at the time for the Israelis and the Palestinians. All of that had been conducted behind closed doors, in secret. In actual fact, the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, Yitzhak Rabin, didn't even know that it was going on until his foreign minister, Shimon Peres, had actually told him and said, yeah, I took this initiative and I've been running with it. And then, of course, the outside world didn't know about it until they appeared on the White House lawn with President Clinton in September 1993. So I think the more that you can do it behind closed doors, the more that you can take the media out of it, because that just, I think, people, especially negotiators and diplomats and politicians, all have egos and they'll probably want to play to the gallery, and therefore the media can feed that. I think that you need to take
the egos out of this. And ego is one of the big problems in trying to resolve conflicts. So you need to really make it as subtle as possible.
And Peter, just to sort of pick up on what you mentioned earlier about these people who are sort of quietly and in jest vilified around these dining tables for their profession, do you think that they're actually much more comfortable, not perhaps in the shadows, but slightly behind the scenes? Is it easier to get these the jobs of diplomacy done, you know, if you're not directly in the press's sights?
I think it's very difficult because you are obliged to be. Everything is monitored and can be monitored. Snowden told us a lot about that. Everything increasingly is reported and can be reported. I think it's probably better that way. I really think, people say, if we keep the horrible press out of this, then grown-ups, realpolitik, grown-ups can fix this. Well, they didn't in the past, and I'm not sure they're going to do it now. When you come to Syria, there's a question, how could that family be sprung? Will somebody put, let's say, a modest 30 billion in Switzerland, home of horrible people's money? We're coming on to Switzerland, I think. Home of horrible people's money. How can somebody put 30 billion, just to tide them over and say he's been a hero and give him a Nobel Prize and get him out of there? And then the difficult thing, how can we find somebody representing our lovely Western interests instead of mad people to put instead? Very difficult, whichever way you do it.
Well, it's probably an intractable problem. Mm. We will indeed pick up on that Swiss discussion a little later. Let's talk, though, more about these kind of figures, these characters who are very difficult to deal with. Perhaps in the context of Cuba, always a compelling example. We now understand that the EU and Cuba may try and re-enter some sort of dialogue, long since suspended, of course. Lauded in Cuba, of course, Matthew, as a triumph of nascent multi-party democracy, this sort of thing. Is there any truth to that, or is it just politically expedient to do this now, do you think?
Well, I think that there is a certain amount of political expedience involved in it, because the whole situation with Cuba, a lot of people, both in the United States and in Europe, think that it's gone on far too long and it's a little bit ridiculous and untenable. And therefore, they need to engage with Cuba from the outside in order to help try to open it up internally. And there is always that argument that rather than isolating certain countries, you need to engage with them in order to foster a relationship, to influence and persuade them. And this was the argument that some who supported détente against the Soviet Union in the 1970s would put forward, that actually if we trade with the Soviet Union, if we engage in cultural and bilateral exchanges, we will actually be able to change them and to make them more like us. And then you have the other argument that you're compromising yourself by doing that. And at the end of the day, these types of regimes will be given succor by being engaged with. But I think really with Cuba, it's about high time that they probably have to go back and look at how they can adjust relations to fit with the 21st century.
I wonder how long that generation will last. How old is Raul Castro? He's pretty old, isn't
he? I think he's certainly 80s, perhaps. Or,
yes. Yeah. When that generation goes, will people believe any of that stuff? And the other thing is, how long can they keep those American cars going before they fall apart? And the third thing is, what is Gloria Estefan's role in all this? Bring her in, I say.
Just as a final point on Cuba, it's interesting the relationship that Cuba still has a nation state and as Castro's sort of state, he's so sort of wound up in it, has with certainly countries within Latin America. There's still many of the sort of more left-leaning leaders there, very keen to still be seen allying themselves with him. Do you think that has an enduring appeal, or it's subject to the same problem, which is that this is not a generation that's going to go on forever?
I'm fascinated. I think in some of the other countries, it skipped a generation and come within Cuba, because the absolute imposition and the sort of the island status, I think it will probably die with that generation. In the rest of South America, it seems to have skipped a generation and come out amongst
quite younger and young middle-aged people. So I'm not sure that will disappear at the same time. I think that his time capsule is implode at different times, don't they? And I think it's rather cheerful to see all these perky people in South America thumbs-upping the United States after what we know happened historically.
Mm. Intriguing stuff. We'll be touching on more intriguing issues in just a moment. We'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Peter York and Matthew Jameson are alongside me. Next up, we'll look at President Hollande. He's had a few problems of late, but now he's on tour in the US. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 21 minutes past the hour. Still with me are the author and commentator Peter York and RUSI's Matthew Jameson. Still both impeccably attired, you'll be pleased to hear. French President François Hollande is currently embarking on a state visit to America, the first of its kind, for 20 years. Since David Cameron failed to convince the British Parliament that using military force against the Syrian regime was a bonne idée, the US appears rather more eager to seek the welcome embrace of France on the foreign policy field. Hollande, under some pressure at home, of course, for various reasons, is no doubt delighted by this change in relations. Matthew, what do you think François Hollande will be realistically seeking to achieve on this trip? His numbers in terms of domestic politics are very, very poor. Mm. He can cozy up to the Obamas, albeit on his own. Mm-hmm. Will it do him any good in the medium to longer term, do you think?
Well, I think what he'll probably want to get out of this trip is quite a limited objective, in the sense that there's not going to be really anything of great policy substance, as far as I can tell, it's coming out of this. I think he will want to use this for PR purposes, to burnish his image as the head of state, as a statesman abroad, on the world stage, dining with President Obama and, promoting and fostering better relations with the United States. So playing the role of the diplomat and the president that he is, though he's having a very rough time at home.
Well, that's discreetly, that's discreetly put. Peter, it's interesting, isn't it, with François Hollande? People are still perhaps understandably more interested in where the First Lady is or isn't, and whether why. Indeed, how they actually deal with that diplomatically at the White House, because Michelle Obama doesn't have anyone to have a cup of tea with. While
they had to pulp the invitations, to get new invitations to say, no, you're not meeting one or other glamorous French lady person. There's just this little squirt. And anyway, that's it to all the glamorous people they were going to have to the White House dinner, which, of course, is a disappointment. I think he also allegedly wants to say France is open for business. We may ask you, American companies, to pay your taxes, but we're there. Don't go to London, where you don't have to pay any taxes. Don't go to London. Go to France. We'll love you to bits. That is probably allegedly the charm. He's going to go and talk to Silicon Valley.
Well, it'll be intriguing to see whether that works. And as you sort of suggested, Matthew, whether it can dig him out of the hole at home. I think he's around 18-19% approval, which is, even by his own terrible standards, pretty awful. What about the big picture, though, in terms of this idea of, you know, the statesman globe-trotting, meeting, you know, the US president in the White House, a marquee on the lawn? can that still really add lustre? Are people not a bit more cynical and a bit more pragmatic about how they look at things in terms of his domestic audience? Mm. Do you think can that sort of charm offensive ever really pay off these days?
I think they are. I mean, the age of deference is certainly well and truly over when it comes to the public and their politicians. And the sort of the glamour and the prestige has worn off slightly for elected representatives, how they're seen at home. But I still think that it does carry some weight in the, you know, the media age. Images are extremely important. That's how most people hear about their politics, see about their politics through the television, and the sight of a French president in all the pomp and glamour, representing his country abroad. Sometimes it can stir sort of a patriotic feeling in people. It's not unheard of, but it's not going to pull his approval ratings way up overnight. That's going to be a long, hard slog.
And Peter, just on that point of politicians, the idea of an audience on Capitol Hill or in the White House, similarly in Westminster, I mean, it still has a certain sort of allure
It can cut both ways. Tony Blair's relationship with George Bush was one of the most corrosive factors for people's perceptions of him in this country. The idea that he was chumming up to Bush, that he'd been done over by the Washington machine, that he had sold our ascent well before the cabinet knew about it, let alone the nation, really made him disliked in this country. And that feeling hasn't shifted at all. Mrs. Thatcher, quite brilliantly, used to go and attack foreigners in a sort of quite focused and calculated way, particularly the EU, when she thought she needed a boost in the polls. So she went and handbagged the EU on a regular basis, saying choosing your friends, one thing, choosing your enemies in a completely focused way is another thing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the EU in a slightly different context. We alluded to it earlier when we were talking about Switzerland briefly. Switzerland have obviously had this immigration policy. It's been kicked around. There's a party, a sort of populist right-wing party, who are largely behind this campaign. And the vote at the weekend highlighted the power, and I guess some people would say the risk, of direct democracy, the Swiss backing quotas for migrants from the EU across their borders. Before we talk about the bigger picture, what do you make just of that vote, Matthew? I mean, it's quite alarming, is it? Or is it perhaps not surprising? And perhaps if we had this sort of direct democracy elsewhere in the EU, we perhaps would see similar numbers.
Well, I find it quite alarming. I mean, I know it was a very close vote. It was only passed by about 50.3%, something like that. So there's no real sort of, overwhelming majority. And it's a quota for EU citizens who are working in Switzerland, who I can't believe it, make up about 23% of the population. But I always get very jittery and very nervous whenever countries start to go down a slightly xenophobic route of clamping down on other people coming into the country. I have serious reservations about what's going on in this country. I think the government has been totally irresponsible with the language and the measures and the sort of whistledog politics that they're employing on the subject of immigration. And in Switzerland, I would be concerned about that.
And Peter, what do you make of that? Is it political opportunism and just political populism, or is it something maybe rather deeper, slightly more insidious perhaps?
Well,
than
it's a very odd place, Switzerland. I mean, the percentage of EU immigrants in that place is very, very high. What we regard as completely stark, nearly a quarter of the nation. And then Swiss people are, the Swiss nation, let's not say Swiss peoples, as I think them utterly charming, we know that, but the Swiss nation is never backward in coming forward in its own selfish interests. So it may be disagreeable, but it's not surprising. And the Swiss People's Party is very, very, very right-wing indeed. Mm.
And just to pick up on that point you mentioned earlier about the money and the refuge for, I guess, what would you call them? International undesirables, perhaps. How much of a problem? Does that feed into this general perception, do you think?
Does it do damage to the brand of the country more widely?
It
does damage to the brand of the country, because if you know about the historic... the historic stores of money from typically dictators of all kinds, the Holocaust gold, all those sorts of things are a problem in another age for Switzerland. And they're doing things about it. I don't know exactly what you don't know how to sort out the PR from the underlying realities. But that's, do you know, anywhere that's a historic great lumping ground for funny money, like London, has to take the odium with it.
Absolutely. Those are the insights of Peter York, the author and commentator. Alongside us has been Matthew Jameson from RUSI. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for joining us here on Midori House today.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To va Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18:31 here in London. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. I'll sit down with the journalist and critic Jude Rogers to review some of the week's music releases. And on a musical theme, the author Robert Gordon will describe the Memphis soul explosion for us. His new book about Stax Records tells the amazing tale. All that and more still ahead. Before all of that, though, let's hear from Paul Osborne. Here he is with the latest World News headlines.
The UN mediator who's leading talks on the crisis in Syria says so far there's been no progress at the second round of negotiations in Geneva. But Lakhdar Brahimi has said he's determined to keep working. Meanwhile, UN aid agencies have said they're increasingly concerned about the fate of hundreds of men and boys evacuated from Homs. More than 300 have been held for questioning by Syrian authorities. Local media in Algeria say that more than 100 people have been killed after a plane crash in the northeast of the country. What's thought to have been a military transport plane came down in mountains 300 miles from the capital, Algiers. China and Taiwan have held their first high-level talks in 65 years. China still says Taiwan is part of its territory with a stated aim of reclaiming the island, but the head of China's delegation to the talks said imagination would be needed to resolve the issues between them. The High Court in London has ordered the British government to reconsider the decision not to hold a public inquiry into the murder of a former Russian spy. Alexander Litvinenko died 8 years ago after being poisoned with a radioactive substance in London. Moscow has always denied any involvement in his killing. And police in Italy and the United States have broken up a major transatlantic smuggling operation, arresting 24 people. They're suspected of plotting to move drugs worth hundreds of millions of dollars from South America. The operation targeted two crime families, one in Italy, the other in New York. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul Osborne will return with more news for you at the top of the hour. Right now, you're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from here in Studio One in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents based somewhere in the world. Today it's the turn of Anastasia Maloney in Bogota. Welcome to the show, Anastasia. Great to have you with us, as always, on Midori House. Let's start by looking at the Pacific Alliance. I gather they've been meeting in Colombia this week. It's been something of a success.
Yes, the Pacific Alliance is a fairly new trading bloc that comprises of Mexico, Chile, Colombia and Peru. And the leaders of those countries were in Cartagena, a Colombian city on the Caribbean coast, yesterday. And they signed quite an important deal. And that deal means that 90% of trade barriers and tariffs between all those countries are now going to be scrapped. And it's quite important because there's lots of other trading blocs in South America, but the Pacific Alliance seems to be forging ahead with a free market, business-friendly approach, and they're really trying to push forward to Asia and get more trade with Asia, which these countries believe is key to their economic growth.
And tell us a bit about how that maybe puts this grouping at odds then with other countries, you know, within South America, because there's certainly, we're used to talking, I guess, more about the kind of protectionism that we see maybe in Argentina, Venezuela. Do you think this really sets these other countries at odds? Do you think it's really going to show an alternative way forwards?
Well, I think the Pacific Alliance leaders are definitely trying to show a new way forward. They want to break down trade barriers. And as you say, that is not what Mercosur, the other trading bloc countries, seem to be doing at the moment, particularly Argentina and Venezuela. So they are trying to set themselves apart. But they wouldn't put it like that. They'd say that this is not an exclusive club that's trying to cause tensions within South America, but just countries that realise that they need to promote a free market policy if they're going to get more business with Asia and between themselves. They also agreed on a joint infrastructure fund, and they're going to regulate and monitor price of medicines between the countries. So there's lots of ways that they're trying to integrate their economies.
So, Anastasia, tell us about, we're used to seeing wiretapping and hacking scandals all around the world. Colombia doesn't want to miss out. It seems there's a bit of a wiretap scandal of its own brewing. Tell us about it.
The latest scandal involves the Colombian military apparently hacking into emails and mobile phones of peace negotiators in Havana. At the moment, the Colombian government and members of the FARC, which is the country's largest guerrilla group, are holding peace talks in Havana. And there's been allegations made in one magazine in Colombia that says that the Colombian military are behind the wiretapping scandal. The president has launched an investigation, and he said that there are dark forces, as he's described it, that are behind the wiretapping in an attempt to sabotage the peace talks in Havana.
Anastasia, let's finish with a story, back on the home front. Let's go back to Bogota. Interesting story about, public transport and potentially the idea of introducing women-only buses. Tell us if you think this one's got any legs to it.
Probably. I mean, women public buses have already been introduced in Bogota a couple of years ago. They didn't actually take off. There were a few huge pink buses going around the city. I'm not quite sure why that project didn't continue, but there have been calls recently to renew that project because of a series of cases where women have been sexually harassed on buses, on public buses in Bogota. And if Bogota did set up these buses again, it would really follow the example of several cities in South America where there are buses and trains which are just used for women.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you very much, as always, for joining us here on Midori House. Plenty still ahead in the programme. Coming up next, we're going to speak to the author of a new book detailing the rise and fall of the legendary Stax Records. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, with a meteoric rise and, in some ways, a comparable fall, the story of the legendary label Stax Records has been compared to that of a Greek tragedy. Home to such artists as Isaac Hayes, of course, has now been detailed in a new book, Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. The author of this volume is Robert Gordon. He joins me on the line now from Memphis, the home, of course, of the record label itself. Robert, great to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us on the programme. Let me start a little by asking you about Memphis, because in so many ways, the story of Stax and the story of the city are intertwined, aren't they? Did you find, as you were writing the book, that you're really writing about a city and its story as much as a record label?
Oh, very much. What happened at Stax happened in contrast to what was going on outside of Stax. So this sort of peaceful oasis inside this studio really only made sense once I began to write about the hateful enforced segregation outside the studio.
And I guess one of the key things was some of the figures in Stax who helped to break down some of these barriers that were surrounding them. Tell us a little bit about how exactly they went about doing that, because, you know, it wasn't easy, was it, in the 60s to sort of pursue that sort of, approach in the country more widely. And yet Stax made such an art of it. How did they do it? What was it about all of these characters that made it easy for them to fly in the face of so many conventions?
Well, you know, I think it was it for the players at Stax and the people at Stax, it was easier than you're making it out to be. For them, they just did what they considered the right thing, which was not judging people on the color of their skin. So while greater society outside was promulgating this enforced racism, at Stax, they just, you know, you walked in the door and you were judged by talent and not by anything else. So they, Estelle Axton and Jim Axton, they were the siblings who founded the label. She ran a record store in the, what had been the candy counter of the movie theater. Jim ran the recording studio that was in the theater in the back. And her clerk was a guitarist named Steve Cropper. And so the two of them kind of met people out front. They met Booker T. Jones out there. They met William Bell, you know, artists. Stax had what they considered an open door policy, and that was in a closed door society.
And they certainly profited from it, didn't they, of course? The growth of Stax was amazing. After we talk about some of the artists I mentioned already, but people like Otis Redding, of course. And I guess in the first phase of the growth of Stax, Otis was really at the heart of it. Before we talk about him and what he contributed before his sad demise, let's hear a little from Otis Redding. This one is Can't Turn You Loose. The unmistakable sounds of Can't Turn You Loose. I mean, that record is pretty interesting anyway, isn't it, Robert? Because it was a sort of a house band song in some ways, that the original riff that the MGs had played. But just so great to hear it, and so great to look at the canon of work that Otis Redding contributed while he was a Stax artist.
Yes, he was very instrumental in shaping what became the Stax sound. One thing I got to point out about that song is it's really... you can hear the drummer as the band leader there. So many people think of the drummer as the anchor, but Steve Cropper and Booker T. Jones and Duck Dunn always talked about Al Jackson Jr. as the leader of their band. He was the drummer in Booker T. and the MGs. And in Can't Turn You Loose, you can hear that he's setting the pace and everyone is marching to keep up with him. And then on top of that, you get these classic signature Otis Redding horn parts. He'd come in with all these, with the whole arrangement in his head, and he would get up in the musicians' faces and sing it right to them and, you know, tell them, do it like this. And the horns really grew from their association with Otis, and I think Can't Turn You Loose is one you can't stop dancing to.
All right, yeah, it's definitely an absolutely great record. Now, Robert, I want to ask you in a second about the kind of the second iteration of Stax, if you like. But just to focus in on 1968 for a minute, this incredible year. I mean, all around the world, there was so much conflict and change that happened then. Of course, in Memphis, it was dominated by the Martin Luther King assassination. And there was this sort of extraordinary tension. There's an incredible picture you have in your book of the mayor of the city meeting ministers, and he's got a sort of shotgun under his desk.
Not a sort of shotgun, man. He's got a real shotgun. It's no sort of shotgun. The mayor, that is evidence of the fear that had been run up in the city. You've described it exactly right. The mayor is meeting ministers, so he's got his hand outstretched, and beneath him at his feet a loaded shotgun. So it was, and Memphis at the time, at Stax at the time in Memphis, was going through more turmoil, because in December, 3 months prior to Dr. King's assassination, they lost their star artist, Otis Redding, in a plane crash, and also their future house band, the Barqués, in the same crash with him. And then a couple months after that, they learned that Stax was losing its whole catalog to Atlantic, this... they'd been double-crossed in a deal with Atlantic Records. And then when Dr. King was assassinated, it was at the Lorraine Motel, which was the hangout for the Stax artists. That was where they could swim in the pool together and they could be served. You know, Booker T and the MGs could record number one worldwide hits together in Memphis, but they couldn't get a barbecue sandwich at the stand because the black people were supposed to go around the back. But at the Lorraine, they could eat in the coffee shop together. So that really does demarcate the time between Stax's first period and Stax's second period, because they come back from nothing. They've gone from nothing to a huge rise to an epic fall, and then they do the same thing again, follow the same path in a second iteration.
Well, that's what I just wanted to ask you about finally, was that reinvention, because there's quite a few stories of record labels and management who managed to sort of pull off the trick once, but they can't do it again. What was the recipe that meant they could come back with Isaac Hayes as they went into the 1970s and build it again? Because it's such a hard trick to pull off, but as you detail in the book, they make it work. How did they do it?
Well, whatever the recipe was, the main ingredient was Isaac Hayes. He came out of nowhere in the era of huge afros. He came out of nowhere with a bald head and established a new sound in popular black music, soul music, and really just became a sensation, a superstar, nothing less than a superstar, peaking with Shaft. And at the same time that Isaac, he was putting out two albums a year, by the way, and all of them were, you know, they were selling gold and just hundreds of thousands in sales, which allowed Stax to grow magnificently. They abandoned this sense of a Stax sound and began to, they really wanted to become the Atlantic that they had served. So they began to license songs from New Orleans, great songs, you know, songs from Detroit, great songs. And so they sort of went from the sound of Stax to the sound of Hits, a place that could have Isaac Hayes and the Dramatics and Gene Knight, you know, all from across the U.S., and grew to have this Watt Stax concert, which became, you know, a feature film and two successful double albums. So they were really a powerhouse, but again, a perfect storm of events between the bank that they were borrowing most of their money from came under federal investigation at the same time that that thugs inside of the label were stealing were taking money out of the label, and at the same time a new distribution deal with CBS was resulting in Stax spending a lot of money on making records, but CBS was kind of strangling them and not sending records out for distribution, so Stax had no money coming in. And so from 68 to 75, it's this huge rise up to 72, 73, and then a really precipitous and nasty fall. And fortunately, there's a happy ending to the whole story because, you know, a decade and a half later, the Stax Museum of American Soul Music is built on the site, and there's a charter school that teaches kids from the community, both academically and musically, and they're having a 100% college success rates. So it's really the spirit of Stax coming back full force.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Robert Gordon tells the story in fine style in Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. It's a terrific read. Robert, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. And in the spirit of what Robert was saying, that the movement lives on, and he was also talking about how the house was built again on the merits of Isaac Hayes. It's only right that we play a bit of Isaac Hayes for you right now, originally from Burt Bacharach, but reinterpreted in his own unique style. This is Isaac Hayes, and Walk On By.
I just can't get over losing you. So if I seem broken in two, please walk on by. Walk on by. Foolish pride, that's all that I have left.
That is the sound of Isaac Hayes of Stax Records fame there, of course. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where we're ticking towards the end of the programme. Before we go, though, it's our daily review, and just listening to Isaac, we've got to keep it on a musical track, which is what we're going to do with the journalist and music critic, Jude Rogers. Jude, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Very good to have you here. Listening to a bit of Isaac Hayes there, we were talking about Stax Records and the Stax Museum. I know you're a... Can we call you an aficionado or just a fan?
Oh, that sounds terrifying because I know Stax aficionados. I don't know the rarities and the obscurities. But on my honeymoon, 3.5... No, how many years have I been married? About 3, yeah.
Important to get that right, Jude. Come on.
Yes, nearly 3 years. 2.5. See, it seems so long. I went on a road trip with my husband and we bought the Stax Singles collection 58 to 68 in New Orleans and basically drove through the south towards Memphis listening to all these Stax Singles. And, oh, buy that box set. It's just incredible. You know, there's some novelty songs in there too in the early days. But it's just amazing hearing how the music developing and then going to the home of where Stax used to be. Well, it's a recreation of where it used to be, and just sitting in front of kind of instruments that were all this amazing music was performed. It's just an incredible thing.
Amazing place. Well, Robert Gordon was talking about how the museum's working now. It's the perfect testament, he was saying, to the whole Stax Records.
Yeah, you've got to go movement. If you're in that part of the world, definitely.
There you go, people. Listen to what Jude has to say. Now we're talking, well, I guess we're bringing a little more up to date in our music review. We'll kick off with KTB, perhaps, shall we?
Yes.
Tell me, there's been a bit of a hiatus. What do you make of the new record?
It's fantastic. It's such a great record. KTB, I think, you know, I'll put my cards on the table here. I think she's one of our best British pop stars now. She's 24. She is an absolute joy to interview. She's bright. She's funny. She's down to earth. I recently went and walked her dog with her in Peckham Rye, where she's from, for an interview, which doesn't happen. That kind of thing doesn't happen very often. She's adorable. And she's made a record that is a real progression from her first album, which is very much a young person going out clubbing, having a great time record. This is you're in your early 20s. It really took me back to that time of my life, which seems a long time ago now. You know, when you're getting used to growing up, moving away from home, having your first heartbreak and all this kind of stuff. But she sings and she performs in this really touching way, really. You know, there's no kind of, there's a real honesty to the way she performs. But, you know, there's quite a few proper bangers, as I think the young people say. Probably don't, actually.
I wouldn't know anything about that, to be honest. Let's let our listeners judge for themselves. Here's a little bit of Next Thing. This is the opening track from the new record. We'll be on to the next thing. So that's Next Thing by KTB from her new record. Do you think, actually, just on that point, Jude, about the gap between, you know, the previous recording, is it a good idea? Take a bit longer, you know, to let your sound develop a little, maybe mature a bit?
Yeah, possibly. You know, quite a few of the songs on this record has been released in last, you know, she kind of had one out on an EP. She's kind of released a few of them off it. You know, that one is one of the more kind of in-your-face kind of tracks, really. But she's taken that real club sound that she, you know, grew up within. You know, she was a Britical graduate, yes, but kind of, you know, she used to sing spots at, you know, underground clubs in London and stuff like that. She's got those sounds of, you know, kind of those kind of stars kind of still in that record. But it's more pop, it's more grown up. And yeah, I don't think taking a bit of time is necessarily a bad thing. You know, people seem to be really liking it.
Good stuff. Where should we go next?
So, the new single out by Lorde this week. Now, Lorde, you know, 17 years old. She hates people talking about her age. I love Lorde. I really do. When I first heard about her, I thought, you know, young, precocious pop star. Gosh, how annoying. I wish I'd been like that at that age. I just think she's fantastic. She, you know, her stuff is very refreshing. She seems to kind of have come out of nowhere in a way. You can know some of the sounds on her records, but she seems to put them together in a way that just sounds very different. And I like the fact that she's so sullen and she's there kind of with her, you know, long hair and her kind of, you know, unconventional clothes, kind of just, you know, scowling at the Grammys. You know, she won 2 Grammys this year. She's met David Bowie. She's basically everybody wants to hang out with this 17-year-old from a tiny little town in New Zealand. And Team is a great track, her new single. You know, it's a real rallying cry for young people. I guess I'm trying to hang on to my youth today. I just realised the songs
with that. Let's hear if this is a rallying cry for sullen teenagers everywhere. Yes. Let's take a listen to Team. Here it is. We'll visit, you'll never see on screen. So that's Team by Lord from New Zealand, as you say. Precocious talent. I guess it's good in a way, isn't it? It's reassuring that there's still room for precociousness and,
yeah,
and to be
it.
Surprised by these young kids. They're not all trying to get into the sort of X Factor crazy sausage production of music. They want to try and get their records out there.
Yeah, and I love the fact that, you know, to me, as somebody who was, you know, a teenager a while ago now, you know, in the 90s, kind of, I hear sounds from that reminds me of my childhood in the 80s. You know, there's elements of that song that really are quite nostalgic, but, you know, we live in cities you never see on screen. You know, I'm from Swansea, you know, in Wales. I could have needed that song when I was 17. But yeah, it's great. And I love the fact that she's not fitting into this typical ideas of, you know, what teenage female poppers have to do. You know, she doesn't take her clothes off. She doesn't kind of compromise. And I think that's a really good message for everyone, not just young girls.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
No compromise. And universal messages. We like those.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Where should we go next? Melanie de Biasio, Belgian singer. Tell us about this.
So, okay. I heard this track on Saturday. I'd never heard of this woman before. And it just knocked me for six, really. It's a cover of a Nina Simone song, which is much more upbeat in its original version. She's Belgian, as you said. I think she's from Brussels. She studied at the conservatory in Brussels as a jazz singer. But this came to my attention through Giles Peterson, the DJ, and I just thought it was a really fantastic version of a fantastic song. I don't know much more about her. I've been trying to find out.
Let's take a listen to it. Here it goes. So this is I'm Gonna Leave You by Melanie de Biasio. Let's take a listen.
I'm gonna leave you. Yes, I'm gonna leave you. Cause I wanna. Then I'll go away. People love me. Then I'll stay there. I'm gonna stay there.
That's beautiful. Just a very short extract of I'm Going to Leave You by Melanie de Biasio, the Belgian singer, and Nina Simone cover. We've had the classics on today, Jude. What of those three? What would be, if you had to pick a sort of record of the week, would you choose one of those?
Well, the Melanie de Biasio just knocked me for six the other day. You know, that it goes on for about 10 minutes and it's just so, it's such a kind of really beautiful, kind of sad, kind of dark, kind of version of that song. I just thought it was really great. So I'd like to hear more of her. So yeah, and
that's your pick.
That would be my pick.
Fantastic.
I do love Katie and I love Lord, but sorry, it's Melanie.
Melanie,
sorry,
this
ladies.
Week. Jude Rogers, many thanks for joining us on the programme. That is just about all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. My thanks to Jude and to my guests earlier in the show, Peter York and Matthew Jameson. The programme was produced by Alad John, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anardo Situma. And our studio manager was Bill Luty. I'm back in the chair at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. Set your watches. But for this edition of Midori House, that is all for today. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.